Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. Thank you for joining me for this week's edition of the SMIE Consulting Midweek Roundup. It's Wednesday, March 20th, 2024, and today we're going to be answering three questions we've been hearing from international educators that we've heard over the last 7 days. And actually, this is the first roundup in about 3 weeks due to some extended recruitment travel, and institutional partnership travel that I conducted this past couple of weeks in Australia and Vietnam. Coming back from those two events in API in Perth, Australia, and GSM, our main agency partner in Vietnam, working with their team in Ho Chi Minh City, and then a day trip up to Da Nang resulted in some very productive visits and some hopeful student applicants in the coming weeks, as well as partnerships coming out of the API event. So back at it after 3 weeks off. I'll be here for the next couple of weeks and then off to do some partnership work in South America for in Colombia and Brazil with partners that we've identified and signed up as of the end of November with the CAIE conference that we hosted in Las Vegas. But on to this week's midweek roundup. The topics we're going to be covering this week, as we do each week, come from our newsletter that comes out on Monday called All the SMIE News Fit to Share. In case you're wondering what SMIE News is, and SMIE in general, that is Social Media and International Education Consulting. That's the name of the business. And the newsletter comes out on Mondays at 9 a.m. Eastern if you subscribe to the email version of that. And I'll be dropping the links to all the stories that I'm covering today, along with our website, smieconsulting.org/subscribe, where you'll be able to drop in and subscribe if you prefer an email version of the newsletter coming to your inbox every Monday at 9 a.m. Eastern. And I'll also drop a copy of this week's edition of that email newsletter in the chat on our social media channels here, so you have that for your reference, as well as the alternate version, which is on LinkedIn. And between the LinkedIn version, which now has 75 subscribers, and the 100 subscribers on the email version, we now have over 1,775 subscribers on both, with a combination of both of those newsletter versions. So thank you to those of you who have already subscribed for making it a part of your international edification each week. And for those of you who join us here on Wednesdays, either live for the chats at 1 p.m. Eastern or on repeat on any of our social channels on YouTube, Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter, or listening on podcast on the audio-only version available on all major podcast providers. We're happy to be a part of your international journey each week. So what our first question of the week is what do Common App's international student numbers tell us about the future of undergraduate international enrollment in the United States in the coming year? Well, these numbers, this particular article comes out of Forbes, and it'll be spoken about in Inside Higher Ed and probably the Chronicle as well. But the gist of this article is showing strong growth in applications through Common App overall, looking at significant increases in institutions who have received Common Apps or have joined Common App over the past few years. The total volume of applications since 2019, pre-pandemic, has increased 65%. And what that's doing, as many of the original owner participants in Common App have been the more selective schools, particularly the Ivies, you've seen their acceptance rates drop dramatically in the past few years as that increase has spiked. So the top schools get more applications, and that's some other trends we see coming out of the most recent Common App numbers is that test optional remains popular, no ifs, ands, or buts about it. 75% of four-year colleges do not require SAT or ACT anymore, and that's despite Yale, Dartmouth, and Brown coming at least some form of returning to at least some form of standardized testing as of the fall 25 intake. This year, they're still test optional. And let's see, more than 415,000 applicants on Common App, and roughly half the total didn't report a score this past year, and that's a 20% increase year on year. So that's a sign that students are at least listening and not appreciating not having to submit to SAT and ACTs as for admission to most of the top schools in the country, though those numbers might change for the three that have come back out. And add MIT to that mix, that you certainly see a lot of the top schools still holding strong and not going back to requiring SAT and ACT. But scrolling down through the numbers to the meat of why we look at it from SMIE Consulting's perspective is the applications from abroad. And the number of international students decreased in 2020-2021 due to the pandemic. No surprise there. But each year since then, according to the Forbes article and the Common App numbers, international applications have increased. Now, in that last 3 years, we've seen the biggest growth in five countries, and they all are from either Africa or South Asia. The largest single growth countries are Ghana with over 1,066% growth, Bangladesh 514% growth, Nepal 470% growth, Ethiopia 369% growth, Nigeria 347% growth. That offsets the numbers that have been coming out, a declining number of undergraduate applicants coming out of China, which has decreased 18% since 2019-20, which overall is a large, not as significant a percentage drop, but certainly because of the volume that China represented before the pandemic in terms of undergraduate applications, certainly that 18% represented a very significant chunk, but we certainly see other countries picking up that slack and then some. But changing dynamics in terms of where undergraduate applications from abroad are coming from certainly reflected in that. And South and East Asia certainly are the growth areas for Common App. And I'm sure many of us will have numbers that are reflective of that in our applicant pools this fall. So it's not a fairly meaty topic to get into first off the bat, but certainly one that is a signpost of a positivity, I think, related to international undergraduate applicants coming to the United States. We'll see as these trends continue. This particular Forbes article was taking a pre-pandemic to now kind of outlook, so it doesn't give granular detail year on year. We may get more of that if Inside Higher Ed or others continue to track this information, but certainly something to follow as we keep our fingers on the pulse of what's going on with current applicants to the United States from abroad. We'll go on to our second major question of the day, and that is, what do U.S. international educators want of the U.S. government? And this is particularly surrounding that age-old question that we always come back to here on the roundup and throughout our conversations with clients and on the university side, as well as colleagues at conferences and fairs are lamenting the fact that the U.S. is the only major destination that does not have a national policy for international education. So this isn't a surprise to anyone who's been in our field for more than a minute, but certainly the future seems to be more momentum gathered around this topic, particularly as we see the foundation of the Coalition for U.S. success that was formed this past fall. These alliances joining forces to rally around the common cause of international education, a cause that used to be a white hat issue back in the 80s and 90s in Congress in the early 2000s until 9/11. But certainly we see more and more the politicization of international education, particularly as it relates to China. We've seen impacts there. Obviously, the war in the Ukraine has impacted Russia. Our perspectives on Russia and China certainly remains the number one kind of challenge for significant growth in our numbers, but also as potential roadblock to future growth in how the Congress portrays the United States and China in a global war for supremacy. So the U.S. international educators were recently surveyed through an IDP coordinated event, coordinated survey that included included NAFSA, the President's Alliance on Higher Education and Immigration, and as I mentioned, the U.S. for Success Coalition and other major organizations. So about 75% of the 400 plus professionals who responded to the survey do work in the field. The majority of these professionals ranked the U.S. dead last, 7 out of 7, in comparison to other leading countries in quote-unquote, in terms of having a successful coordinated effort to support international education. So that doesn't specifically mention strategy, national strategy, but certainly reference the implication is that, yeah, we do poorly on that front in the U.S., and no one's going to deny that, but certainly ranking us dead last is probably no big surprise, given what Canada, U.K., Australia, New Zealand, Ireland have done to attract international students in recent years as countries with much smaller higher ed populations, much more centralized control over higher education, as opposed to the U.S., which is a complete decentralized mess, with a Department of Ed really being a figurehead and only really having no real influence on international education other than financial aid for U.S. students to study abroad. So this Nathan Greenfield article in University World News points out is that we have a challenge here in the United States with regard to not having that policy, national policy or a coordinating body that serves to play that role. There are three different articles that I'll be dropping in links to that are relevant to our discussion today and are certainly good food for thought. If you haven't already read them, certainly would be worth giving a quick read over, none are more than 3 or 4 minute reads, so it's well worth your time, if just to be able to have a sense of what's going on in our country with international educators. Again, it was only 400 of these responses from higher ed professionals who are in our field. But the reality is each of these articles represents slightly different tacks on what's going on. The University World News article focuses, and there's a quote in here from Fanta Awe, NAFSA's executive director and good friend, that says, relative to other countries, we have tremendous capacity in terms of our educational system at the higher education level. And yet we have not even scratched the surface of our ability to attract as many students who wish to come and study in the United States relative to other countries. Study after study has indicated that when given a choice, students would select the United States among the top 2 or so destinations. So that's from Fanta. And so I love Fanta to death. She takes, always looks on the bright side of things, always has a positive reaction and approach to challenges in our field. And this challenge of not having a national strategy is certainly one that she's well aware of and has experienced herself, both from the institutional side and in her current role as executive director of one of the leading international ed organizations in the world, certainly here in the United States. And she's making the point on the positive side that, hey, the potential is so much greater than our current levels of success in international student recruitment and maintaining those relationships. So she's saying that, hey, if we had a national strategy, it will ensure that would ensure all key government organizations and agencies and associations were on the same page. And the goal, and she rightly points out, is to highlight the breadth and depth of diversity of our higher education system, from community colleges to flagship public institutions to private higher education. So as she always does, she encapsulates everything that needs to be said about what is missing and what we could be doing and achieving if we were together and had a unified national strategy that supported the enrollment of international students in a more positive way. So the There has been what is called an aversion to national strategy in this article too, which is a little bit interesting. Australia and Canada are federations that have federated countries where their states or provinces have primary responsibility for higher education. But much like we would say in the U.S., there are states that will have somewhat of a defined strategy for international education. But that's 50 of us in the U.S. There are 5, 6, 7 provinces in Australia, maybe 8 or 9 provinces. Only 6 of which are 7 of which are maybe active internationally. The numbers just reflect, yes, in the provinces in Canada, they each make their own decisions, but they still have the federal IRCC that is responsible for immigration regulations. And we're seeing some of the challenges that are now coming into play with the cap that has been put in place on with a 35% reduction in student study permits that will be issued this year and next, and what that implications are by province is different. Some provinces have higher weight, and so they get a greater share of the number and have a little bit more political capital that they can expend to say, hey, no, we need a little bit more than you're promising, because financially it's going to have a great impact on our institutions negatively by reducing the number of international students that they can enroll. So their financial implications are all around the world, but in terms of our ability to grow, if we were to have a unified strategy, I think the potential is unlimited. So in terms of what we're looking at, so that's the University World News article. An ISF Monitor version of this refers to the U.S. being the only major destination without a national strategy. But this survey highlighted the need for U.S. international educators need for that strategy and establish some clear priorities that include building a more diverse enrollment, and so improving the competitiveness of the United States and growing market share, that type of thing. So that's the IDP or the ISF Monitor version of this. The points of consensus among respondents to the survey were that any national strategy in the U.S. should prioritize a quote-unquote modernization of work pathways, very important, visa policies, and opportunities for residency post-graduation. All three are areas that we've talked about here on the roundup as that are things that need to be upgraded and addressed. We know in the U.S. we haven't had major immigration overhaul since the late 80s, so there's a huge demand for that. But politically, it seems to be dead on arrival. Any bill that modifies any, particularly with the Dreamers and dealing with the border issues, all of that. International students are probably the least dangerous of the mix in that mix, but they get shuffled in with all the other challenges we have with immigration whenever something is proposed. There's never a one-off bill just to deal with international education, unfortunately. It's always part of some omnibus bill, so often gets doomed to failure. So the key that the survey results revealed was that diversity also emerges as a key theme, with strategies proposed to address visa denial rates in key markets, provide scholarships for underrepresented groups on the national level, and promote study abroad opportunities to a wider range of students. So no surprises there, very straightforward, and I don't think there are any international educators in the U.S. that would not agree with that. So that's the ISF Monitor version. In the Pi News version, I do want to pay particular attention to the focus on visas. And why do I do that? The focus on visas in this part of the push for a national strategy for international education, part of the challenge with visas is we all know in the U.S. We have the most complicated visa process. We're the only one of the top 7 destinations that requires a visa interview. All the others have third parties that process these, either embassy officials in certain countries get paper applications or electronic versions of applications and make those decisions. We are the ones that require, if they've never had a visa to the U.S. in the last 5 years, they have to go through a personal in-person interview. Prior to that, everybody who wanted a student visa had to have an interview, but they've made exceptions in the pandemic that if you've had a previous U.S. visa and gone through all the security clearances and interviews previously, you do not need an interview again in within the last 5 years. But the challenge is even that and that those kind of accommodations that were have been made to those that have already gone through the process recently, you still have that that process that is dependent on physical time slots being available for every available applicant to go physically to a consulate or embassy of the United States in their country before to have that interview before they can even have a chance of getting a visa. And that process we know is really laborious and is very cumbersome and is completely dependent on the number of staff hours that each consulate and embassy around the world can commit to student visas. We've seen great success in India in terms of addressing the huge upswing in demand. That's still not perfect, but they've made huge advances in terms of accommodating that huge volume of applicants for student visas by opening a new consulate in Hyderabad that has 100 or so windows, maybe 75 windows, making it one of the largest in the world. The four of the top five busiest consulates for student visas are in India now, so they're really doing some tremendous work in terms of volume. But the problem with the visa process, other than having to do that interview, is that students have to prove a negative that they aren't planning to immigrate to the United States. Even though it is technically legal to do that after transitioning from OPT time to H-1B to permanent residency and then citizenship over many, many, many years. It took my family from the time we entered the United States in 1974 to the time I became a citizen in 1987, 13 years to become a citizen after entering the country. So that was 6 years of 6 years of L1 visa, L2 status for myself, 6 years of permanent residency, green card status, and then a year or so to get in the mix for citizenship, to become a naturalized citizen. So it's a long road. That's at a time when it was actually pretty easy to go through that process back in the 70s and 80s. But now it's a much more lengthy process and certainly leaves many applicants struggling to fill those gaps over the years to stay in the country legally. So a lot of challenges there. But even though it's legally possible for an F1 student to come into the country, study, and then eventually transition to citizenship, they have to prove at the time they go for that visa interview as an 18-year-old, if they're coming for a bachelor's degree, they have to prove that they know what they're going to do with the rest of their life and they have an excellent plan and they have strong ties to their home country, that they're planning to come back eventually and be able to articulate that and to demonstrate, yes, that they're not planning to immigrate, even though they could. So that, because of the interview, because of that requirement, because it is the F1 student visa is a non-immigrant student visa, non-immigrant visa category, as is the J1 exchange visitor, the interviews that are required put the student at distinct disadvantages as opposed to any other country that they are applying to in the major English-speaking world. So what I've certainly called for years, what I know in communicating with colleagues in the higher ed association world, they support wholeheartedly. It's actually been in a few bills, immigration bills that have been submitted to Congress that had bipartisan support in the Senate, but not in the House. So that would be making F1 students or that F1 category a dual intent category, so that they didn't necessarily have to prove a negative that they weren't planning to immigrate to the United States, that they could potentially go either way, which is legally what they can do, but making the reality of the status that they're applying to before they come to the visa interview, making them aware that it's okay to be either not to come home right away or to have a plan to stay when you're done. Because the reality is it's possible to do that, but they can codifying it in regulations to allow that possibility to happen so that consular officers don't have to make that decision to deny a student for 214B, which is the non-immigrant intent piece. That is the single biggest roadblock for students not getting visas, is because The presumption is that they are going to immigrate. Until they prove otherwise, the consular officers have that negative impression in the back of their head that the student is intending to immigrate, and as a result, they can deny him for 214B because they think they're planning to immigrate, even though it's legally possible because it's a non-immigrant visa category. They can't say that they want to immigrate in that interview. So that's the biggest conundrum in U.S. higher education as it relates to international education, is that visa status. F1 being a non-immigrant status that requires the student to prove a negative. If it were called a dual intent category, it would be possible, like an H-1B, that's a dual intent. It's a work visa, but you have legally have the ability to continue on afterwards to apply for permanent residency, apply for your green card. So that is the one piece of the PI article that I really wanted to draw attention to, because the focus was the need to, on the U.S. government's part, to update visa requirements for academic students and J-1 visas for exchange students to broaden access. We are really at a disadvantage there, and particularly in certain markets where they have high denial rates that are based on, they're not coming home, they're just planning to immigrate. If that F-1 category were dual intent, we would not be having near the challenges in visa denial rates that we have around the world. And if that interview were removed entirely, we'd be even in a better position. So that is the challenge we face with this internationalization strategy. I'm going to move quickly on to the last topic of the day, and that has to do with our friends across the pond in the UK. And this, for those that have been following it, there's been a lot of focus in recent weeks on the drops in international student numbers for the spring and also coming up for the fall. And we see now what the fallout is going to be in certain countries, in certain universities in the UK. There have been a number of universities that have already announced job cuts amongst the foreign student admission drop. And there's a BNN News article with that title. Talks about the financial woes that in UK universities are experiencing are across the country that are reflecting international students compose 24% of the total student body in higher education in the 2021-22 academic year. That the proportion for the up and the challenges with these international students at 24% of your total, they are paying more than double what domestic students are paying. Those fees are, because they're such a large percentage of the student body, are sustaining institutions now and allowing them to do the things that they're able to do. But the projections are for the upcoming financial year, there's going to be a 37% drop in overseas student admissions. So as a result, institutions are going to be issuing letters of redundancy, basically firing or laying off staff at Sheffield Hallam University. More than 120 staff were offered voluntary redundancy. You have other institutions like University of Kent proposing 58 job cuts, eliminating 9 courses. Northumbria University highlighting a predicted 71% reduction in Nigerian students due to the currency collapse, but also probably due to the dependent ban that wouldn't allow them to bring for master's level degree programs dependents, family members with them. Not just the currency devaluation. So there's some big challenges going on there. Second article is from ICEF Monitor that talks about the impact that the graduate route, which is their post-study work visa program that currently allows international students to work for 2 years when they're done with the program. That is under review now by the UK government and could potentially cost billions to the UK economy if that work rights was canceled or curtailed in any significant way. It was eliminated entirely during Theresa May's reign in the late noughties, early teens. Didn't get reinstated until about 3 years ago. So some significant challenges ahead for UK unis in terms of their the amount of financial woes that they could be experiencing, both on the front end with the visa restrictions that have been put in place, but also on the back end with the loss of potential post-study work that could have a double effect, double whammy on future student interest and reputational damage for UK institutions. So that's all we have for you this week on the Midweek Roundup. Challenges are galore in the U.S. and abroad, but certainly positivity in the U.S. about potential national, international education strategy here. But many more miles to go before we get to where we need to on that front. So until next week, we wish you the very best and stay tuned for more. Cheers.